we got to see Tomino! And Nina even got to meet him.
This is Mobile Suit Breakdown, and we are recovering from our very first Anime NYC. We are very pleased to be able to report to you all on our impressions, experiences, and the excitement of going to an anime convention in the 40th anniversary year of Mobile Suit Gundam.
An anime convention that was attended by none less than Tomino Yoshiyuki himself.
New York even declared it Gundam Day on the 15th of November, which was the Friday, the opening day of the convention. First impressions of the con as a whole, as convention centers go, I really like the Javits. That's the big convention center in New York City, and it's where most of the large cons happen.
It's a cavernous building, basically all glass. Pretty cool.
Although I don't know if we should talk about this or not, the security was appalling.
Yeah, there was practically no security.
Nobody really even checked badges except for if you were going into a panel. There was some very desultory checks of badges going into the exhibitor floor. It may have been different if you had a prop weapon for part of your cosplay. I did see several tables devoted to prop checks. However, I was there with a big old backpack and they sort of peeked inside the main compartment once. And that was it.
Also, that the only security they had was for getting into specific rooms, like the panel rooms or the show floor, but none at all for getting into the building.
Yeah, so for the whole food court, all the halls, all the open spaces of the convention center, anybody could have come in if they wanted. Probably some people did. Probably some people came just to hang out without having bought tickets.
And that level of disorganization really did feel emblematic of the whole con. Not that the con ran poorly. I think it actually ran surprisingly smoothly for what was going on. But when we first arrived on Friday, we got there hours early to make sure that we got into the Tomino panel, which was going to be held at 3 o'clock. But from about 11 o'clock when we got there until maybe 1:30, we spent almost that entire time trekking around the con trying to find out where we should be lining up for the Tomino panel.
We received three different answers from three different people. We did, however, meet some fabulous cosplayers. We met a Ramba and Hamon, who were also trying to find out where the line was going to be. Oh, and a Basque. One of their friends was also Bascom.
So we all worked together in the spirit of Gundam, crossing those battle lines to all try to get into the Tomino talk together.
I had initially thought we might attend the Sunrise industry panel that they were going to do at noon, but we were worried that if we went to that, we would be too late to get into the Tomino panel. We were very concerned that we might not get into that one. And it turns out our concern was reasonably well-founded.
Yeah, the line for the Tomino panel ended up being absolutely monstrous. And we did hear from somebody who got into the Sunrise panel that that panel was pretty sparsely attended, probably because everybody who really wanted to go to a Sunrise industry panel also wanted to see Tomino.
They did at least have a massive room for that panel. It was way bigger than I expected. Really fantastic use of the space, but I'm pretty sure it was full.
I expect that it was.
We managed to get front row, almost center seats. Very proud of us.
Well, we managed to be literally the first two people in line for Tomino. We were that excited.
Probably the biggest disappointment for me was that having seen the number of people and size of the room, I thought to myself, oh good, if it's this many people, they can't possibly do audience Q&A. I was wrong.
We just want to say that if any of our listeners were in those queues for audience Q&A, and if any of our listeners asked questions, we thought your questions were great. It's all the other questions that we're talking about.
Don't get me wrong, there were some great questions. I'm not saying audiences can't ask good questions, but I think for the quality of the experience, those questions ought to be screened by someone. There were some egregiously bad ones, and we might get to that later or not. I don't know. I don't want to pick on anybody, but like...
Sure. Let's just say there were some questions that were bad because they were bad questions, because of the nature of the question. But then there were some questions that were just rude.
And some that were clearly like, I have the opportunity to talk at my hero.
Now, I will say this about the questions. When you ask Tomino a question, there is a maybe 5% chance that you're going to get an answer to your question. He'll answer, he'll say something, but what he says and what you asked rarely have a direct connection.
He made a lot of jokes, he made a lot of deflections.
It often seems like he goes into any one of these panels or interviews with a couple of things that he wants to say, and he's going to say them regardless of how you prompt him. And he's just flat out going to avoid answering any kind of specific questions you try to put to him. He will never tell you what his favorite anything is. Don't even bother to ask him.
Before we get into the content of the panel and the questions, I need to get something off my chest. It kills me how many people mispronounce Tomino's name. And like,
including people who really ought to know better.
I don't want to be snobby about it. Like, I know I've gotten to study Japanese. I have that privilege. But if you're a professional talking about this guy, and maybe it's a small thing, I don't know how noticeable it is to other people. Maybe it's just because of my ear or whatever. But people put a lot of emphasis on the middle syllable. They say Tomino, Mr. Tomino. And I'm exaggerating for effect, but like...
Not that much.
Mr. Tomino. And then at one point, people started chanting his name. And when people do a chant, they put the same emphasis on every syllable. And it actually sounds much closer to the Japanese pronunciation. Tomino. Tomino. Tomino.
That chant happened a couple of times.
Yeah. It's a good name for chanting. Anyway, I did a lot of like flinch. Mr. Tomino. Anyway, moving along.
So the format of this panel is not the right way to describe it. It's Tomino, his translator, and then the moderator. Moderator, again, maybe a little too generous, the host of this interview, who was Austin Walker, who does various podcasts and games writing and is a high-profile Gundam fan in the English language side of the fandom. And the first half of the panel, with quotation marks attached, was Austin interviewing Tomino and asking a series of questions. And then the second half, they opened it up to questions from the audience.
Tom has had a favorite way of describing this that I think he should express in audio.
The thing about getting to interview Tomino, especially if you're a Gundam fan, is that you have to accept you're going to get up there and you are going to be publicly dunked upon by your hero. Because that's what Tomino does. It doesn't matter who you are or what kind of questions you ask. Tomino is just going to make fun of you. He might eventually settle down and start answering seriously, which is what he did during this panel, but he is still going to be making fun of you the whole time. So my endless sympathy to Austin Walker. I would not have been able to do any better.
It's also very difficult to tell when Tomino is being sarcastic.
Yes, absolutely. He switches back and forth between them really rapidly. Sometimes you can tell he's being sarcastic. Sometimes you can tell he's being earnest, but most of the time you have no idea which one it is.
Well, in response to the very first question, he didn't actually answer, but he said, I always think people who ask such questions must be really amazing. Really, erai.
The translator.
She was great.
She was fantastic. She had so much sass. She was perfect for Tomino.
Well, and was perfectly willing also to shut down questions that she knew were not like permissible.
Tomino was asked the sort of standard set of questions. Did you think Gundam was going to be a hit? Why do you think Gundam was such a hit? Things like that.
I quite felt for him on a creative level. Obviously, I've never created anything that anywhere approaches the popularity of Gundam. But to the question of sort of why do you think Gundam has been such a hit? And he says, why don't you tell me why it's been successful? I try to make everything a hit and most of what I make fails.
Which
is just art all over,
right.
Isn't it?
Right.
And you don't necessarily know why people like one thing and not another, you're just following a creative impulse.
And that's the way it is for most creators, even most high-profile, really skilled, really famous creators. Most of what you make is not going to catch fire.
But then he takes a sharp turn from this sort of self-deprecating angle of like, I don't really know why things that I do well or don't do well. And when asked about the enduring popularity of Gundam, the fact that it has stayed popular for so long, said, watashi wa tsukutta kara, which made me burst out laughing before the translator had finished. It means, because I made it. So really pulling the auteur card and taking all of the credit.
But then later in the interview, he did actually expand on that a little bit. It was in response to a different question, but I do think it was a more complete response to this one, which is to say that when he makes a work, he always tries to make it in a layered way so that you can enjoy it when you're 8, and you can go back and watch it again when you're 15 and find different things in it, and then again when you're 25, and again throughout your whole life, you can keep going back to the same work and finding different things in it to enjoy and to expand your conception of the work.
Although coming back to the being dunked upon, he made no bones about the fact that Gundam was not for the majority of the people in the audience.
Yeah.
They're like, y'all are too old. I didn't make it for you.
You're not my demo.
He mentioned that he likes movies more than TV, that there's a sense of newness, that there's an ability to do more technologically and more with the story that is different and sort of experimental in film than in television.
Yeah, I thought this was one of the better questions that was asked. They said, you know, of all the media you've worked in, which is your favorite to work in? Mm-hmm. And for this one, most of the time when you ask him about a favorite, he'll say,
I don't favorites.
all of them are my favorites, which he said a couple of times during this interview. But when asked about media, he was very clear. He said, I prefer to work in movies. But he also mentioned that it's in writing novels where he feels like he has the most freedom and where he was able to most clearly distinguish himself from the other people also working on Gundam.
Right. He said he largely got into novels for licensing reasons, but it's as the author of these novels that people began to associate him with Gundam as the creator.
For better or worse.
Yeah, I found it very interesting how willing the audience was. And I think this is just a product of fandom when somebody has that strong association, when somebody is an auteur in that way. But for everyone to just kind of accept him as creator and act as though he had sole responsibility for all of these creations. And I'm sitting there thinking, there are whole teams who worked on this stuff. At one point, someone asked us, oh, if you could ask him a question, what would you want to know? Because we didn't get the opportunity to interview him. And I was thinking, and I don't know if he would answer this, but what additions have other people made to his stories? Because he's working with a writing team. He doesn't write it all himself. What additions have other people made that he felt really added something, really fleshed things out, really improved what he had already done? And just as we were talking here, I would be very interested to know about his experience now that he's older, working with young teams. Like, is there a sense that working with younger creators keeps him grounded in that, like, youthfulness and keeps him from getting too sort of, like, stolid and set in his ways? Because he talks about that a lot. He talks about age a lot. He said both that he doesn't feel like he's changed in 40 years, but also that it is a daily struggle to avoid becoming worse.
And that flowed out of a question about changes in the mechanics of making an animated movie or show or whatever, asking, you know, now that you're working on Reconquista and G, how is the showmaking process different from the way it was when you were working on First Gundam? And he says there's not a lot of differences for him, personally. He has sort of an old school approach to this, except that the technology allows certain things to be done that couldn't be done 40 years ago. He specifically mentioned making the colonies donut-shaped. He said donut-shaped. Even in Japanese, he was saying donut. But I'm pretty sure he's talking here about the donut-shaped design for the Stanford Taurus colony, which is a space colony design roughly contemporaneous to the O'Neill cylinders that we've talked about on the podcast and that actually did appear in First Gundam and became quite iconic, became one of the essential elements of the Universal Century. You see an O'Neill cylinder in fiction, it's probably Gundam, or at least Gundam-inspired. So to hear him say, oh, yeah, the whole time I wanted to use this entirely different colony design was pretty cool. That was a neat revelation, if it's true. I mean, this is Tomino. He is a fount of lies. But he said drawing the inside of a donut-shaped colony is a lot harder than a cylinder. They couldn't do it at the time, and now, with the computer assist, they are able to do it. Which prompted one of the funniest exchanges of the entire talk, where Austin asked him, oh, why did you want it to be donut-shaped? And Tomino, like, puts his head down on the desk. And then he gets up and he says, I really wish you already knew the answer to that question. Searing. He was on fire.
He was very expressive, very smiley, not like in a hand gestures way, but pulling lots of funny facial expressions. And when he got into an answer, he would sort of lean forward across the table toward the audience. He did that sort of like head down thing a couple of times when sort of overcome by the humor of something. Austin asked him if in all the themes that he's dealt with in these 40 years worth of Gundam, there's a particular theme that is the closest to his heart, the most enduring, the most significant for him personally. And this was one of those funny, maybe it's an answer, maybe it's not an answer ones. He said, what if the theme were that I wanted the Earth to be eradicated? I couldn't just blurt that out.
So this is funny whether or not he actually does think the theme is that he wants the Earth to be eradicated. And it gets to something very true, which is that people are always asking him, what are the themes of X or Y or Z? What's the most important theme? But the themes are there, whatever he thinks about them. And him talking about them doesn't actually make them any stronger. In a way, it just makes them weaker, because the themes are at their best when they stand on their own.
We'll get into that a little more when we talk about day two and the panel he attended then.
This response about the Earth being eradicated then prompted him to go into what felt a little bit like a audience-pleasing bit, but also could have been entirely genuine, which was his comment that seeing the response of the people around the world, and in particular the people in that room, made him feel really good about himself, about the world, about the future, made him feel like he needed to imagine good developments in the human future as well as bad ones, and hold on to hope.
Well, and then his sort of vision artistically is that gloom is for adults, but that young people should be using the creative process to find hope and to find solutions.
So I thought this was maybe the single most important thing he said in the entire interview in terms of better understanding his work. So if you're taking notes, take note of this one. Adults are a negative example. You're supposed to watch Gundam, see how the adults are behaving, and not behave like that. You're supposed to think it's bad, especially if you're a kid. You're supposed to see these adults cynical, pessimistic, gloomy, cruel, violent, and run away from that. Be the opposite of that. And that's something that we've suspected watching Gundam, but to have him say it when he was sitting a couple of meters away from us is pretty cool.
I think one of our most interesting conversations about the talk came out of this next bit. He did a little bit of what I considered at the time pandering to his audience, where he talked about how great New York is and how much he loves the vibrancy of the city, the excitement of it, the energy, the emotion, that he just really liked the experience of being in New York City and the people there. However, as we talked about it some more, we started to realize that in some ways, New York is closer to his old vision of the future than a lot of other places would be, in its multiculturalism, in the fact that there are people of so many different races and ethnicities, so many people who speak different languages, who have different fashions, who are so expressive.
And if you listened to the special episode that I did with Sean and Ali about Gundam F91 a couple months ago, and if you remember, we talked about how a bunch of those characters looked like they had just walked straight off of a New York City street in the early 90s. As much as it seemed like pandering to the audience, I kind of believe him. I kind of believe that New York is actually closer to Tomino's ideal of how the world ought to be than practically anywhere else. Sorry, non-New Yorkers. We are Tomino's favorite.
In response to the person who had a problem with all of the new type stuff, I regret to inform you that when asked what the most important message of Gundam is for him personally, Tomino said, we should all try to become new types.
All of us.
So, guess that's kind of essential. Sorry.
And then in a moment of pure Tomino sass, he was asked, what themes and messages do you think Gundam should cover in the future? And he came as close to saying Gundam should end as he possibly could, because he basically said, nah, we've covered everything important. I think we're done. I think we did enough.
Someone asked a question that I thought was quite interesting, actually, although the way it was phrased sort of took a long time to get to the point. But in essence, they were asking about art as healing for people who are experiencing like suffering in the world. They even mentioned, you know, someone who is physically ill, somebody who had cancer, and how art relates to human suffering. The question was phrased in a way that made it all feel very grandiose, that art is all powerful and can solve any problem.
He was talking about art as this like personified light force that could be used to heal people.
And Tomino sort of brought things back down. For all that Tomino is an artist and clearly takes it seriously and thinks it's important, he said that art can create hope, but not healing. that healing itself is on the person and on society and solving societal problems. Art can create hope. Art can hypothesize solutions. But actually addressing that pain comes down on a much more practical, lived level.
Because these were questions submitted by the audience with no vetting or organizational principle except who could get to the microphone fastest, they don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, so we're going to try to group them a little bit. There were a bunch of questions about what is your favorite XYZ, including who's your favorite character, what's your favorite scene, things like that. And for all of these, he was very reluctant to give an answer. Who's your favorite character? I love all my characters equally. Except
he did mention that the most personally relatable characters for him are often background characters who are not a big part of the episode. And the way he phrased it in Japanese, if I understood correctly, almost implied like that he becomes regrettably attached to these characters, that he doesn't think he should. But he does, through the process of the work, become somewhat attached to background characters of his.
And I think that's something you can actually see through his work, especially when you watch some of the later stuff.
Oh, and he similarly insisted no favorite scenes, no favorite episodes.
His favorite part is the whole thing every time. Somebody asked him to recommend one of his non-Gundam works, and he gave a pretty funny response to this. He said, I have a policy to never recommend any of my stuff, because I think that if the creator pitches the product, that means either it's bad or it's unsuccessful, and I won't demean myself by stooping to that level.
He also gave the impression of being a total control freak when it comes to creative output. Somebody asked him about whether he had written the lyrics for so many Gundam songs because he wanted to, or because it was necessity, because they couldn't pay someone to do it. And he said it was necessity, but it was necessity because the lyrics he was getting back from people were not quite what he wanted. And similarly, someone asked him about the project they have to make a life-size moving Gundam for the Olympics.
Oh, I thought they were talking about the live-action movie. I don't know. It was unclear.
It was a little hard to understand.
Somebody asked him about some kind of real-life Gundam
that's being made. And he said that he had been very involved, but no one was listening to his ideas, and so he is not involved anymore, and he expects that he won't like it. He claims not to have watched any Gundam for the past 10 years, which I believe, I think.
I totally believe that, too. I find the 10 years mark interesting, though, because that suggests he watched some of the non-Tomino Gundam from more than 10 years ago.
I can't help but relate this to Aidango recently translated another one of his Ask Tomino columns, and someone was asking him for advice. And the question was about Twitter and, like, basically, why do people feel the need to be so negative about things other people enjoy? Characters from anime, stuff people watch. And Tomino's response is basically, get offline, kid. And that when you feel that impulse to respond, you really need to look at why you personally feel so compelled to respond to this other person's negativity. And he said when he feels that urge, he claimed, when he feels that urge to respond, he sits on it for a year or more before actually deciding whether or not to do anything about it. Which makes me think, like, oh, was he watching a bunch of Gundam and had a bunch of very strong feelings about it and was like, oh, these strong feelings I have about a thing I didn't even create are, like, not good and not helpful, and so I'm just not going to watch it.
That could very well be the case. Well, and if he did stop watching around 10 years ago and then took a couple of years to think about it, that would more or less line up with the timeline for when he started working on Reconquista in G.
He mentioned that the Reguild Century, which I'm not familiar with yet, but I did hear the name, exists because the people of the Universal Century learned nothing.
Womp, womp, womp.
He claimed that he had no influence from American science fiction.
That's not quite what he said. Because he said he had influence basically from American science fiction that came out before Gundam.
Mm.
But then once he started working on Gundam, he was too busy to even go watch a movie or a TV show.
Mm. Which I buy, given what we've heard about the production schedule. And
him being a complete workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
But he did actually, I think if I'm interpreting it correctly and if the interpreter is interpreting it correctly, I think he did confirm that there was an influence from Star Trek, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. And one tidbit that I feel like almost deserves a research piece. Tomino recently did an interview in Playboy Japan where they were asking him about some of the most prominent anime directors right now. And he expressed a sense that anime now is too chaste.
And he specifically called out the works of Shinkai Makoto.
So somebody asked him, what is an example of something that is sexy enough? Like, if most anime now is too chaste, what's an example of something that you think is sexy enough? And he said, well, I don't know that sexy is quite the right word. And I don't know if you can understand this, but Disney's Snow White, which I think is so illuminating. And I would bet money that there are academic papers on sex and sexual subtext in the Snow White fairy tale.
I'm not going to take that bet.
And we now have an excuse to watch Disney Snow White, which Tom has never seen before. He's shrugging dramatically.
Sorry. So there were a few questions that I would collectively call the real fandom questions. First, somebody asked him, how does he come up with the names, the famously weird Tomino names? And he didn't really give an answer. And the answer he gave, I suspect he was being sarcastic, but I really can't tell. But he said, it's very hard. Each and every time I have to come up with a name, I sweat profusely. I always want it to be completely unique, but sometimes I have to use existing words or existing names. And if you have watched any Tomino anime, you know that he constantly uses existing words as names. So like I said, I don't know if he was being sarcastic. He was laying it on pretty thick with the how hard he works and sweating bullets and all of that, so.
He did say he was being figurative. He figuratively sweats profusely.
Someone asked if there was going to be a Turn A prequel that explained how they ended up in the situation at the beginning of Turn A, to which he said, no, I never even thought about it. And because I never even thought about it, I know that I couldn't do it. So I view Turn A as done. Sorry. Someone asked him, what with him going back and redoing Reconquista and G, whether he had considered going back and redoing F91. He sort of laughed, and then he said, no, not F91. And finally, the question that gets asked every time he comes to the US, is there going to be a Crossbone adaptation? At this, Tomino leaned back in his chair, laughed for a long time, and then said, I think so. Now, I don't know if he was being serious or joking, or if this was more of a, well, of course they are, they've run out of ideas, they're going to keep making Gundam forever, eventually they'll get to Crossbone. But you heard the man, Crossbone Gundam is getting an adaptation, maybe at some point.
Somebody loudly shouted, we love you! To which he responded, I love you too!
And he doffed his cap and bowed on the way out, as we were all standing and cheering and chanting his name. There's great energy in that interview hall.
He did say that there was something kind of unique about his experience of American fans, that it was different from his experience of fans in Japan, which made me really curious. I didn't know if this, again, was meant to be sort of pandering, like, you guys are so special, or if there's actually, like, a big difference in the way fans interact with him here versus in Japan.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to ask him next time he comes to New York.
I think we should write him a letter.
I think you should write him a letter.
Thanks to the Tomino panel, we made a new Gundam friend. Our voices were recognized a couple of times, which was really cool.
Yep.
And we met someone who was writing a master's thesis in the history department of their university on post-war memory and a Gundam wing. So we, of course, want to read it the moment it's done. Or Tom can. I probably have to wait a few years. I have to wait until we get to wing. But that was very fun.
Yeah.
Wandered around the show floor, looked at some incredible Gunpla, of which several listeners submitted entries. This was for Gundam World Builders.
Gundam Builders World Cup.
There you go. I had some of the words.
Congratulations to listener and patron Tex for winning third place in the Gundam Builders World Cup, and to listener and patron Bro Builder, who took best in show. Huge congratulations to both of you. You can see their work on Twitter and probably in various other places too.
Really impressive stuff.
So much for day one.
We had been sort of iffy about the first panel of day two, but I am so glad we wound up going. It was called 8 Ways to Analyze Anime and was presented in its description as very academic. It was being led by a professor, sounded rather technical in the description. We get there and there is already a line. And by the time we get in, it is standing room. There are people standing around the edges of the room. The room was packed. Much smaller room, obviously, than for the Tomino panel, but not tiny by any means. Lots of people very interested in academic analysis and academic work on anime.
And the popularity of this field actually did come up during the question and answer period at the end of the panel. A couple of people asked questions on some variant of, you know, is academic analysis of anime becoming more mainstream, more accepted in academic circles? And the answer is yes. Increasingly, anime is being accepted as a valid text, valid kind of literature for this kind of analysis.
It was led by Christopher Bolton, who teaches at Williams, I believe. So he has worked on a number of different publications. He worked on some early issues of Mechademia, which is an academic journal, basically, about anime and Japanese popular culture. He edited, I believe, Robot Ghosts and Wired Dreams,
which is a collection of essays about sci-fi in anime. And it was one of the texts that I read during my preparation to start this project more than a year ago now, but it's really good. It's fairly accessible for academic writing, and it's a great primer for how to think deeply about anime and sci-fi.
And more recently, he wrote a book called Interpreting Anime that basically takes a series of different anime works and analyzes them with different frameworks to kind of show the different ways in which you can look at an anime and try to make sense of it. In structuring his talk, he used Akira, the film, though he also refers to the manga at several points.
And then he walks through the 8 different ways to analyze anime in his framework and shows how each one of them can be applied to Akira and how they are not really independent. They all work together to give us a better understanding of this work.
I don't think we'll get into the specifics of Akira necessarily here while we're talking to you guys, but to talk about some of how these different frameworks sort of play with each other and apply to our own work on Gundam. The first one he mentions is historical frameworks. This is pretty clear. We are constantly tying Gundam back to real historical events. What is perhaps key to the historical framework is to some degree you're attributing intent to the creator. So when we make these historical connections, are we saying that, this is just like this historical person or event, and that was done deliberately?
Right. There's an assumption not just of intentionality, but also of purpose, that these historical parallels are being put into the work in order to convey some message. And in its purest form, a positive message. And by positive, I don't mean good, but I mean active.
It's supposed to mean something. There's a message. There's a purpose to the reflection and connection.
We should do X, we shouldn't do Y. There are instructions to be found within the work.
In what feels like almost direct opposition to the historical framework, we have the theoretical, which has to do with postmodernism, not a term that I was very familiar with before this, so I appreciated his explanation, which was essentially that postmodern art doesn't mean or communicate anything. Other than confusion and excitement, that it conveys an aesthetic experience, but it doesn't have any independent meaning. It's media about media. It's works that reference previous works rather than any original happening.
I find it's helpful to think about this in visual terms. So imagine the historical work as a bunch of arrows, and all of the arrows are pointing at things from the real world, at people, at places, at events. Contrast that with the postmodern work. Still a bunch of arrows, but the arrows are just pointing at other arrows, and those arrows point at other arrows, and those arrows point at other arrows, and it keeps going around until you're either pointing at the original arrow again, or you're pointing at something real, but at such a distant remove that the meaning has become completely distorted and lost before it arrived in the work.
Exactly. He described postmodern works as not really giving coherence or a solution.
They're about creating the impression of something, about giving you the emotional response that you would have to something, not necessarily about offering you any kind of solution or way out.
The third framework is called formal, and this is what a lot of us think of when we think of film studies and film criticism. Color, editing, composition, use of light, use of music, the sort of fundamentals of how the thing is built.
And what those mean, what those say, but also just from the theoretical perspective, what impressions they create. How does the editing create chaos, make you feel chaos?
Or imply connections, or create meaning.
Or destroy meaning.
Fourth, we have comparative, which is, you know, comparing anime with other anime, comparing it with manga, with novels, with theater, with live action works, and so on.
And Professor Bolton made the point that the real value of the comparative framework is that it allows you to see what the anime is doing by seeing what it does differently from other similar works, especially if the anime is an adaptation of a manga or a book. What changes were made can tell you a lot about what is going on in the anime.
And can help you notice strengths and weaknesses of a work when you compare and contrast it with other works.
So those four, historical, theoretical, formal, and comparative, are, as he called them, the big four, the ones that academics tend to focus on.
Particularly for film criticism, but this is, I think it's begun to spread to other media criticism as well. And then he gets into some other stuff, and this was one of my favorite parts of the talk. He was discussing visual commentaries, visual critiques of anime works, and he mentioned AMVs, cosplay, and fan art.
AMVs being animated music videos, which if you've been around the internet for a little while, you've probably encountered, but if you haven't, this is where someone takes a popular song that is unrelated to a particular work and then cuts up film from the anime, sets it to the song to create their own music video.
But he makes the point that any interpretation of the original work through an AMV, through cosplay, through fan art, is commenting on the work.
Absolutely.
In ways that a written essay never could.
Gender-swapped cosplay. Slash fix.
Doujinshi. You know, fan art that uses the style of one artist to draw the character of another.
And the difficulty in talking about all of these is we almost can't even express the ways in which these visual commentaries comment on the original work because it's so visual. We don't have words for it, and we don't need them. When you see these works, you can see the comparisons. And then the final one is what he called visual academic criticism, although from the way it was presented, it felt like this was just three question marks. Something in the future.
Well, but he does mention the video essay, and he mentioned one of our favorite series, Every Frame a Painting. And while there is text, while there is someone speaking and explaining, much of what they're conveying is done through movie clips and editing, and how those clips are edited together to make a point, to show a trend, to show a contrast, whatever. Comics as criticism, and he mentioned Scott McCloud, because how can you not? He does feel like the progenitor of that in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a thing that existed before him. If you're not familiar, Scott McCloud created a comic called Understanding Comics, and it is about understanding comics as a visual medium. And the professor himself is in the process of creating a museum exhibition to talk about popular culture and mass media in Japan, entirely visually, with as little text as possible.
Which sounds very cool, very challenging.
He mentions that he's working with theatrical designers because a lot of how the exhibit is going to work has to do with sight lines. What things are you looking at the same time? How does your eye travel from one thing to another? That's really going to make or break those visual connections. And he does mention that there are likely to be new and hybrid methods, and the things that jumped to my mind immediately were video games, virtual reality, and interactive theater.
Hmm. You never even considered long-form podcasts?
I feel like a long-form podcast really is an essay. We just happen to be reading it aloud to you. It doesn't feel like a new approach to me. You think it is?
I don't know. I do think there's something unique about the way the podcast allows us to talk about these ideas both in a long form and over a long period of time while also developing our ideas week to week. The serialized essay, if you will.
That's true.
And to talk to our listeners and to get their thoughts and to reinterpret our thoughts in light of theirs.
That's very true. And this didn't come up in the visual academic criticism portion, but I would say that when Tom creates visual collages and memes with Gundam or with Gundam and other media, he is providing us with visual academic criticism of the show.
Behold me, I am an academic.
I mean, if an academic institution were to employ us, hey, we could teach a class a week and still make the podcast. Our new history academic friend asked two questions that led to two very interesting moments. One was she wanted to know if Professor Bolton knew of people in history departments working on anime, because it, based on what research she's done, it seems like it's mostly media studies, East Asian studies, literature, film departments where that kind of media criticism is happening, and not as much in history departments. And two historians jumped up out of their seats and handed her their cards. And then also, she was discussing the focus on the historical perspective, and he mentioned that to his mind, why talk about anime if you're not going to talk about the visual? That obviously the text and the dialogue are important, and there is a historical perspective to be had there, but it feels like you're missing a huge portion of what there is to be conveyed if you are not bringing that analytical eye to the form itself. The other fan question that I thought was really interesting was somebody was asking about basically knowledge of Japanese culture and how essential that is for interpreting and analyzing anime. And Professor Bolton mentioned some people feel like there are certain visual and behavioral or cultural codes that you need to learn. That like a young woman makes a young man a bento, and that means something that you don't necessarily know what that means if you're American. And so there are people who reach or try to have a sort of base knowledge of the culture before they try to analyze it. But his feeling was that you can provide analysis without having that. It's really about you and your interpretations and your reaction. And while it's possible to take a lack of cultural context too far, people probably shouldn't get too bogged down in feeling like they need to be culture experts before they can analyze anime.
Your feelings and your impressions when you watch something are valid. And no one is ever going to be able to watch anything and 100% perfectly understand everything in it, no matter who you are. Even if you're the person who made it, you're not going to perfectly understand it. And maybe understanding the culture allows you to understand the work in different ways or a little bit more thoroughly, but that doesn't take away from the value and the validity of the things that you find in it when you watch it.
We left that panel having met yet another couple of Gundam analysis contacts. Part of the reason I joked earlier that we need to write Tomino a letter is we talked to Professor Bolton very briefly about our project and what we're doing. He mentioned Tomino has expressed on occasion some frustration that there seems to be a lot of analysis and academic work on Evangelion or Ghost in the Shell, but nobody is doing academic work on Gundam, and this frustrates him. And that Professor Bolton thought that part of that is because there's just so much Gundam. Nobody right. knows quite where to begin.
Most academics working in media studies on anime are going to do a movie, or at most a brief series, 4, 5, 12 episodes. Engaging with something like Gundam, which, as we have observed, contains approximately 1,000 episodes at this point, is a project of staggering size.
I can't speak to this, obviously, with much authority because I'm not an academic, but the depth at which an academic looks at a particular work is, I think, greater than what we do. You know, they'll spend months or years on something that we spend a few weeks on. So, of course, they're going to look at Gundam and be like, no. Whereas we're like, oh, it'll see us through to retirement.
And even if you could say, oh, I'm just going to watch the 6-episode Long War in the Pocket and do my academic analysis of that, you might very reasonably look at that project and say, I don't feel like I can do this justice unless I have at least a baseline understanding of the other 994 episodes of Gundam.
I then got to have my fangirl moment, which is to say, I was lucky enough to win one of the spots by lottery to have Tomino sign something for us. I decided to take our Blu-ray of First Gundam. I took the second box because I think it has the cooler art on it, but wound up deciding while I was in line to have him sign the interior of the paper so that the signature would be more visible. Having him sign over the art would not have shown up very well. He has a very cool signature. He drew a really cute Haro. I posted to our Patreon a photo. I wish I could tell you that I told him about the podcast or asked him a question or anything, but I was a little nervous and basically just said thank you and smiled. And he was very smiley and nice. And then I moved right along because they had a lot of people to get through in the queue.
I'm very jealous. But that's okay, I guess. At least one of us got to.
The signature is for both of us. Oh, we forgot to mention. During the panel, someone asked him about Char and Amuro's relationship, but something about, like, how do they feel about each other over the over the years or something.
Something
and,
like that.
And Tomino was like, you would have to ask them.
All in all, it was a great experience. We enjoyed the con very much. We loved meeting those of you who were able to find us, and we apologize to anyone who was looking for us and couldn't track us down. We will see you next time.
Currently debating whether or not we should try to attend Anime Boston?
Yeah, if you're going to be there, let us know.
And have I sounded any different today? Because we capped off the weekend by going to buy me a new microphone. I have been doing more editing on the podcast recently, helping out with that part of things more. And for lack of a better way to describe it, I felt like my voice sounded a little thin. Tom's voice has this wonderful rich timbre.
Hello.
I think Tom sounds fabulous. I didn't like how I sounded on the recordings. And it occurred to me, and it turned out that I was right, that different microphones probably suit different tones and pitches of voice differently, you know. They're calibrated for a particular range, and if your range is different, it's not necessarily going to make you sound as good as you might like. So we went and we tried out a couple of different microphones. We got recommendations and tried out a couple of things, and may have found a new listener because, you know, when you're trying to pick out a sort of mid-tier microphone, you have to describe what you're using it for. And so we got to tell the staff person at the shop about the podcast. And when we gave him our card, I was very struck. His reaction was, oh, so it is Gundam. Like, based on our description of what we do, but without mentioning the show, he had already thought that it would be Gundam.
He seemed very skeptical when we started describing the podcast, but by the time we had finished, he seemed pretty into it. So hopefully he will start listening.
Hello. Yes, you.
Thank you to all of our patrons for collectively helping us buy Nina a new microphone.
I hope it sounds amazing.
It already sounds pretty good. The intro song is Wasp by Misha Dioxin, and the closing music is Long Way Home by Spinning Ratio. You can find links and more in the show notes. And thank you for listening.
Tomino-san. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be much point in recording while that is happening.
Nope. Well,
when this stops, we can try again. We just need to keep an ear out.
Yep. All right, sounds good.
They're working on some exterior repairs to our building, and the work crew is like right outside our window today. Yep. It's very frustrating.
Yep.
Do you have that question written down? I have the response.
I think I was doing something like this with my face
from the previous
asking the question.
I'm going to have to cut that, because otherwise I have to explain the joke, and then you know too much about us.
We have to maintain our aura of mystery, our mystique.